tubes and the test tube rack we'd need for our lab. I put them in the cards for everyone in the club. But still, how do you know it isn't worth hundreds of dollars? I don't, but I assume my dad wouldn't give it to me if it was worth a lot of money. I shrugged. I have a bunch of stuff like that.
Did you ever think that maybe he gives it to you in spite of the fact that it's worth a lot?
Do you want it or not? I snapped. Miles dipped his chin and stared balefully at me over his glasses, shoving the coin deep into his pocket. He turned back to the card.
Did you make this?
He said.
Why is it only in green?
Charlie's on a green binge right now. It was the only color I could find. He scanned what I'd written inside the card. Dear asshole, thank you for keeping your word and believing me. It was more than I expected. Also, I'm sorry you were inconvenienced by my gluing your locker shut at the beginning of this year. However, I am not sorry that I did it because it was a lot of fun. Love, Alex. When he finished reading, he did something so surprising that I almost dropped the Bunsen burner and set the kid across from me on fire. He laughed. Our neighbors turned to stare at us because Miles Richter laughing was one of those things that the Mayans had predicted would signal the end of the world. He wasn't particularly loud about it, but it was Miles laughing, a sound no mortal had ever heard before. I liked it.
I'm definitely keeping this.
Miles went back to get his black notebook. He slid the card into it and came back to the lab table where he continued to be completely oblivious to the staring, and happily helped me start the lab. The club seemed to really enjoy their gifts, even before I explained what the drachmas were. Jetta, who knew Greek, spoke it for the rest of the day. The triplets also wanted to know how much their coins were worth, and if they could pawn them.
Probably if you can find the right person, I said. But I'll hunt you down if you do.
The club had a thing about giving one another gifts. Jetta, who planned on moving back to France someday to become a fashion designer, made everyone scarves. Art handed out amazingly realistic wooden figurines he'd made in shop class. Mine looked like a long-haired Raggedy Ann doll. The triplets actually sang a Christmas carol they'd composed themselves. Miles walked into the gym about 5 minutes after they'd finished, holding a large white box filled with giant cupcakes. Everyone gorged themselves while we watched the basketball practice. I didn't eat mine. I stacked it on top of the scarf and the figurines in a pile next to my backpack, with the excuse that I'd eat it later. I probably wouldn't. Not because I didn't trust Miles. He just wasn't as attuned to food poisons as I was. Afterwards, the triplets started singing again, but this time they treated Miles to a nice round of, "You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch." I got one other gift. And at first I wasn't sure if it was really a gift or a misplaced piece of sidewalk. A fist-sized chunk of rock sat on my desk without any explanation. I couldn't really blame the person who left it. I'd left one of my drachmas and a card full of apologies on Tucker's desk, but he could have at least explained what kind of message a rock was supposed to send. But I kept it, partly because I was curious and partly because I'd never been one to throw away gifts. Chapter 29. Christmas at the Ridgemont house was a lot like Christmas everywhere else. It was the only time of year my parents bought a lot of stuff. Most of what we got were things that had gone on sale after Christmas last year. Charlie didn't notice, and I didn't care, because most of it was clothes anyway, and if they fit, they fit. Our presents appeared beneath the tree, both Charlie's and mine, with cards from Santa. Every year on Christmas Eve, Charlie and I made Mom and Dad go out to dinner by themselves, and we made sure they went somewhere they'd actually eat the food and enjoy themselves. It meant my dad was happy, and my mother was out of my hair. At my request, Mom bought the ingredients for a Black Forest cake. Charlie got carried away eating the cherries while the cake was in the oven, but luckily we still had enough to cover the top edge. It looked delicious and was guaranteed 100% poison and tracer-free, which I was ecstatic about. Sometimes it felt like I only got happy this way around Christmas. The rest of the year I wondered if the point of Christmas was just spending money and getting fat and opening gifts, indulging.
But when Christmas finally comes and that warm, tingly mints and sweaters and fireplace fires feeling gathers in the bottom of your stomach, and you're lying on the floor with all the lights off but the ones on the Christmas tree, and listening to the silence of the snow falling outside, you see the point. For that one instance in time, everything is good in the world. It doesn't matter if everything isn't actually good. It's the one time of the year when pretending is enough. The problem lies in getting yourself out of Christmas. Because when you come out of it, you have to redefine the lines between reality and imagination. I hated that. After New Year's, a few days before we were due back at school, I asked my mother if I could go to Meijer with her. She gave me a strange look, but didn't ask why, until I packed up a piece of our second attempt at a Black Forest cake. Miles works at Meijer. I wanted to see if he was there today. Charlie demanded to go with us, and when we got into the supermarket, I held the plate of cake in one hand and steered Charlie toward the produce section with the other, while Mom got a cart and went to shop. I'd been in Meijer plenty of times since I was 7, of course. The deli counter hadn't changed at all, and the lobster tank was right in the same place. The lobsters still crawled over one another in their desperate search for escape. I propelled Charlie toward the tank, and she watched the lobsters as intently as I used to. The only difference was she never tried to set them free. Despite the rush of post-holiday shoppers in town, the place was curiously empty. I worried that Miles wasn't working. But then a door behind the counter swung open, and he walked out. "Hey! You are here!" Miles froze like a cat caught in a flashlight beam. "What are you doing here?" he asked. I balked. "Shopping, of course. Bit of a rude question to ask a customer, don't you think?" I passed the piece of cake over the glass case. "I hope you can keep this back there somewhere or eat it really quick. Just think of it as an extra Christmas present. It's a Schwarz..." Miles laughed. "Schwarzwälder Kirschtorte," he said. "A Black Forest cake. Did you..." "Charlie and I made it," I said, motioning over my shoulder to where Charlie stood, munching on a black night. Miles frowned over my shoulder. For a fleeting moment, I wondered if he thought she looked like the 7-year-old me, standing next to the lobster tank with a 7-year-old him, asking for help in freeing the lobsters. Would he remember that if I asked him? Part of me was too scared to find out. "She's cute at first," I said, "but trust me, it wears off when she crowns herself the Pope and declares the bathroom religious grounds." "She's done that before?" Miles asked. "Oh, yes, several times. Last time I tried to take a shower, in fact. You could hear her screaming about blasphemers all the way down the street." Miles laughed again. I was almost used to the sound by now. I looked back at Charlie, whose attention had started to wander. I came to see if you were here. Thought you'd like the cake." Suddenly there was nothing left to say. I was bothering him. I knew it. And why had I decided to bring him food at work? He plucked the cherry off the cake and stared at me as he chewed. I wished I had put more cherries on that slice. The whole jar of cherries. I could watch him eat a whole jar of cherries. Jesus Christ, on a pogo stick, what was happening to me? I tugged hard on my hair and turned away, but he said, "Hey, wait, before you go." I turned back. He rubbed his neck, looking off to the side, and didn't say anything right away. "I have another proposition for you," he said, and at the look on my face, he quickly added, "Not like the last one. This isn't a job, I swear. There's, something I wanted to ask you. You said that you couldn't find anything else about Scarlet and McCoy. My mom went to school with both of them, and I figured if you wanted to,
yes?"
Miles took a deep breath, held it in with his chest puffed out, and looked at me warily. Then he let the breath out and said,
"Do you want to meet her?"
I blinked at him. "What?"
"You know that monthly trip I was telling you about? I'm going up there again before school starts. I could pick you up on the way.
It's almost an 8-hour round trip, though, so if you don't want to, that's okay.
The more words that came out of his mouth, the more his face fell, like he thought it was a bad idea. I let him run out of steam before I couldn't take his pitiful expression anymore and had to stifle a laugh.
Yeah, I'll definitely go.
I never thought I'd have such a golden opportunity to talk to his mom. There was no doubt she'd have whole treasure troves of information about Scarlet and McCoy. And... oh, shit. I swayed on the spot. This was about more than Scarlet or McCoy. He wanted me to meet his mom.
I just agreed to meet his mom.
He perked up but still looked apprehensive, like if he said, "Really?" I was going to say, "No."
"I'll have to ask first," I said.
"But I should be able to."
"When are you going?"
"Saturday. I leave pretty early in the morning, so..."
"Don't worry about it. I'm an early bird." I saw my mother rounding the corner, heading for the lobster tank and Charlie.
"There she is now. I can ask her."
"No, that's... you don't have to..."
But I'd already waved her over.
"Miles invited me to go with him to visit his mom," I said.
My mother examined Miles, obviously remembering when he'd brought me home during my episode, and Miles glanced from my mom to me, giving me a panic-stricken look I'd never seen on his face before.
"You're going to visit her,"
my mother said, with definite interest, but with that edge that suggested she thought Miles meant visit her in jail.
Yeah,
he swallowed thickly.
"I go once a month, and it's nothing serious, really, but, she's in a hospital in Goshen."
"A hospital?"
Miles looked at me again.
"A psychiatric hospital."
My mother was completely silent for at least a whole minute. When she spoke again, her voice was careful, but almost happy.
"Well, I think that sounds like a good idea," she said.
Miles looked relieved. But my stomach sank to the depths of the ocean. Why was my own mother so okay with me visiting a mental hospital? Why was that a good idea at all? It kind of felt like she was kicking me in the gut. And every kick said, "I don't want you. I don't need you. I don't love you." Chapter 30. Saturday morning, Miles stood on the doorstep in his bomber jacket with his hands shoved deep in his pockets. His breath fogged the pane of glass in the front door. He looked me up and down. Pajamas and cat slippers.
"Why aren't you ready to go?"
"My mom says I need to invite you in for breakfast." Miles glanced over me toward the kitchen.
"I didn't realize you were eating. I can wait in the truck."
"No, no, it's okay." I grabbed his sleeve and pulled him inside. "Seriously, this'll all go over easier if you come and eat." Miles looked toward the kitchen again. I knew he could smell the food. My mother had been wafting scents toward the front door since she'd started cooking this morning.
"Your dad is home?" Miles asked.
"Yeah," I said. A line formed between his eyebrows. "He's mostly harmless, but you have to remember your history." I lowered my voice to add, "Not everyone's dad is a complete asshole." That seemed to convince him. He shrugged his jacket off. When I took it from him, it nearly pulled me to the floor. "Christ almighty!" I heaved the unexpected weight back up. "Why is it so heavy?"
"It's a heavyweight flight jacket," said Miles. "I have another one that's lighter, but it makes me look like a greaser." "What are you doing?"
"Smelling it." I stuck my nose in the collar. "It always smells like tobacco."
"Yeah, it would. Opa smoked a lot."
"Opa?"
"Sorry, my grandpa."
I hung the jacket on the coat hook next to the door and pushed Miles into the kitchen.
"Oh, you're here," said my mother with fake surprise. "I've already set you a place at the table right there next to Alex."
Miles's eyes glazed as they roamed over the scrambled eggs, sausage, bacon, toast, and orange juice on the table. I pushed him into a chair.
"It's nice to finally meet you, Miles."
Dad reached over to shake Miles's hand. Miles stared at him like he'd lost the will to speak.
"Staying for breakfast before you head out?" I guess, said Miles. Great. How much do you know about the French Revolution?
Like what?
When did it take place?
1789 to 1799.
June 20th, 1789 was the
tennis court oath.
1793 to 1794 was the time period for the
Reign of Terror,
Miles answered, rubbing his neck. And Robespierre's full name was
Maximilien François-Marie Isidore de Robespierre.
Well done, sir.
Dad grinned.
I like him, Lexi. Can we eat now?
I filled Miles's plate for him, since he seemed to be paralyzed from the eyes down. Dad peppered him with history questions until they made it to World War II, and then they moved into an analytical discussion of wartime tactics. Charlie didn't come out the entire time Miles was there, even though my mother had set a place for her. I'd been looking forward to introducing her to Miles. I had a feeling he wouldn't mind fueling her word of the week 1,000 times over. When the meal was left in scraps and ruins, Miles checked his watch and straightened up.
We'd better go. It's already 9.
I got dressed, and then we moved to the entryway to pull on coats and shoes.
Oh, Alex, wait. Don't forget to take these.
My mother sorted through a pile on the hall table.
The cell phone, your gloves, and here's some money if you stop for food on the way back.
I shoved all of it into my pockets and kissed her on the cheek.
Thanks, Mom.
I turned back toward the kitchen.
Bye, Dad.
Bye, Lexi,
Dad called back. Miles stepped out the front door right before Charlie came barreling out of the kitchen aiming for me. She slammed into my legs.
When are you going to let me come with you?
Someday, I said. Someday I'm going to travel the world and you can come with me, okay?
Okay,
she mumbled. But her eyes snapped up and she jabbed a finger at me.
But I'm holding you to it.
I won't let you down, Charlemagne. Chapter 31. I wondered how Miles made this trip every month without losing it. There was no music, no stereo, just an endless stretch of US 31 between Indianapolis and Goshen. My delusion detector went off less and less while I was around Miles. Had his offer to meet his mother come any earlier this year, there wasn't an Ice Cube's chance in hell I would have taken him up on it. I would have gone nuts trying to figure out if he was lying, if it was some elaborate plan, or if he was just going to leave me in the middle of nowhere and laugh all the way home. But his presence didn't set me on edge anymore. The opposite, actually. Since Tucker and I were no longer on speaking terms, Miles was the easiest person to be around. Maybe better than Tucker, even, because Miles knew. He knew, and he didn't care. And he didn't seem to mind being around me, either.
So what's your mom like?
I asked when we got off 465.
I don't know, said Miles.
What do you mean, I don't know? She's your mom.
I don't know. I've never had to explain her to anyone before.
Well, what does she look like?
Like me.
I rolled my eyes.
What's her name?
Juniper, he said.
But she prefers June.
I like it.
She was a teacher. She's smart.
Smart like you?
No one is smart like me.
I've got a question, I said. If you're such a brainiac, how come you never skipped grades?
Mom didn't want me to, he said. She didn't want me to go through the things she went through when she skipped grades. She was always excluded from groups. People made fun of her.
Oh.
She probably won't stop smiling the entire time we're there. And don't mention anything about my dad or where I live. I don't like to worry her with stuff like that.
I nodded, thinking about Miles slinking across his rooftop and dropping down onto the demon dog's roof.
That dog.
Ohio, Miles said.
Yeah.
He's your dad's dog?
Yes. My dad got him partly to keep people from getting into our house, partly to keep me from getting out. He thinks I sneak out to meet people.
But you do.
He has no proof, Miles said.
Anyway,
Ohio's not that smart and sleeps like a narcoleptic, so I guess he and my dad were kind of made for each other. He stared at the highway, then said with disgust, "I hate dogs. Cats are so much better." I made my snort sound like a cough. We drove on in silence for another few minutes. I tried to burrow a little deeper into my coat. "You didn't eat much at breakfast," I said.
"I wasn't that hungry,"
he replied.
"Liar! You were looking at that food like a kid from a third world country.
Your mom's cooking was really good."
"I know, that's why I eat it.
After I check it for poison, of course. Terrible deflection, by the way.
You could have said, because I feel awkward eating too much at a family gathering with people I've never met before, and been done with it."
He coughed loudly, his fingers tapping the steering wheel. Eventually, Miles pulled off the highway and into a heavily wooded suburb. Everything was coated in blindingly white snow. He only took the back streets, and the more houses we passed, the more I realized that this reminded me of where I lived. These could have been the same streets.
Maybe all paranoids had a sort of sixth sense for detecting places that wanted to lock them up. I knew the hospital as soon as I saw it. A squat, one-story brick building surrounded by a fence. Bare shrubs framed the front walk, and snow-covered trees dotted the grounds. It was probably pretty during the rest of the year. This whole McCoy Scarlet Celia thing seemed silly now. Hardly substantial enough to get me inside a mental hospital. McCoy could do what he wanted, and Celia could deal with her own problems.
"Are you okay?"
Miles asked, yanking my door open. I managed to unbuckle my seatbelt and slip out of the cab.
"Yep, I'm good."
I balled my hands into fists and held them tight against my sides. Next to the front walk was a sign. "Welcome to Crimson Falls Residential Psychiatry Center." Crimson Falls? It made me think of spilling blood. And in crimson lettering, no less. My fingers itched to take pictures. But the little voice in the back of my head told me that if I did, orderlies would jump out of the bushes, throw a pair of shackles on me, and never let me leave. I'd never graduate high school. I'd never go to college. I'd never get to do the things normal people do because normal people don't get so melodramatic about visiting mental hospitals, you idiot. That voice was so ambivalent sometimes. It looked more like a hospital on the inside, where the floors were checked tile and the walls were exactly the right shade of taupe to make you want to kill yourself. A girl not much older than Miles and me sat behind the front desk.
"Oh, hi, Miles."
She handed him a clipboard. Miles put both our names on the visitor's log.
"You missed morning rec time. They're in the cafeteria right now. You can go in and grab some food."
Miles handed her back the clipboard.
"Thanks, Amy."
"Say hi to your mom for me, Kay?"
"Sure."
I followed Miles down a hallway to the left of the reception area. We passed another set of double doors that led into a rec room being cleaned by attendants. A little farther on was a smallish cafeteria, filled with 7 or 8 patients. Miles went in first. I followed in his shadow, tugging on my hair and trying to shake the feeling that men in white coats were going to jump out and grab me. There was only one food line in the cafeteria, and about 10 square tables in the middle of the room. Large windows let in the sun. Miles navigated through the tables without so much as a glance at the patients, intent on only one of them, on the far side of the room. He was right. She looked like him. Or rather, he looked like her. She sat at a table near the windows, rolling around a few green beans on her plate and flipping through the pages of a book. She looked up and smiled a radiant smile. It was almost tooth for tooth the same as his, only easier, more used. And it was not the smile of a crazy person. Not the smile of someone who injured herself because of swinging moods. It was just the smile of someone who was very, very happy to see her son. She stood to hug him. She was tall and willowy, and the sun gave her long sandy hair a golden halo. Her eyes were the same as his, too. The same color as the clear sky outside.
The only things they didn't share were Miles's freckles. Miles said something to his mother and motioned me over.
"So, you're Alex," June said.
"Yeah." My throat felt suddenly dry. For some reason, maybe because Miles had so willingly hugged her, I felt no need to check her for weapons. I didn't feel anything strange about her at all. She was just... June. "It's nice to meet you."
"It's so nice to meet you, too. Miles talks about you all the time."
And before I could think about that, she pulled me into a tight hug. "I don't remember mentioning her before," Miles said, but he rubbed his neck and looked away.
"Don't listen to him. He's been pretending to forget things since he was 7 years old," said June. "Sit down, you two. It's been a long drive."
I kept quiet and watched them go at it, talking about anything and everything. When Miles explained things that happened at school, embellishing small facts and details, I'd jump in and correct him. June talked about what it had been like when she'd been in school, the people she'd known.
"Do you know what your senior prank is going to be yet?"
she asked, face lighting up with excitement. I hadn't immediately taken her as a person who enjoyed pranks very much.
"I thought up ours when I was a senior at East Shoal. Of course, not many people followed through with the entire plan. We only got to the first part of it."
"Which was?" asked Miles. June smiled vaguely.
"Setting Mr. Tinsley's Burmese python loose in the school."
Miles and I shot looks at each other, then back at June. "It was you?" I said incredulously. "You set the snake loose?" June raised her eyebrows.
"Oh, yes. I don't think they ever caught it, though. That worried me a little."
"Mom, that snake is a myth now," said Miles. "People think it's still there." I started to tell them that I'd seen the snake, that I'd been seeing it all year in the science hallway. But they pressed on, sweeping the conversation away. The more she talked, the more I realized that June knew history. Not the history my parents were having an affair with, but personal histories. She learned the events that made up a person's life, and she used them to understand why they did the things they did. Miles knew words. She knew people. So when I started explaining McCoy and Celia and everything that had happened this year, she absorbed it the way my parents absorbed war documentaries, with complete seriousness. I talked, and she listened. The only thing I left out was the part about McCoy having it in for Miles.
"Celia sounds like a handful," she said,
after we'd vacated the cafeteria and moved into the rec room.
"I went to school with a girl like that."
June settled into her armchair, crossing her legs, relaxed and thinking. June had the same cat-like look about her that Miles did.
"She was exactly like Celia sounds. Cheerleader, very high-strung, very... what's the word I want?"
"Driven?" Miles offered.
"Ah, yes, driven. And stubborn. All from her mother before her. The woman was a brute. Hardly gave her a moment of rest from the time she could wear heels. Both of them got what they wanted."
June shook her head.
"We called her the Empress. Empy, for short. Boys fell to their knees for her. Richard McCoy, you wanted to know about him, too? He was head over heels for her, and not in the cute puppy dog way. He had a shrine to her in his locker."
I snorted. It looked like McCoy was serving new mistresses now, mainly Celia's mother.
"But Empy was never interested in him, oh no," June continued. "I remember the day she started dating the captain of the football team, because when Daniel went to his locker after school that day, all of his things were scattered in the hallway, torn up. We all knew Richard did it, but no one could prove it. And he groveled at Empy's heels until the day she died."
"Do you remember that? What happened?"
"Well, it was a few years after they, Empy and the football captain, got married. Right after our senior year, she was pregnant,
and used it as leverage to make him marry her. She came back for our 5-year reunion and was standing under the scoreboard talking about her glory days and her father's philanthropy, and it fell. They say she died at the hospital a few hours later, but I think the scoreboard caught her in the head just right, and she was gone on the gym floor. Richard was there. I heard that he still followed her around after high school, and he tried to lift it off of her. They said he looked unreachable, like his whole reason for being was pinned under that scoreboard, and nothing tethered him to the world anymore. I shivered. Do you think McCoy could be obsessed with someone else now, like he found a new tether? It's possible. Was that why Celia was doing all this terrible stuff to other people? Because McCoy was doing something to her? That changed things. I had really hoped Celia's involvement in all this was just some byproduct of her need to be popular, something she'd wished on herself. But more and more it looked like she was caught up in something she couldn't control. And if that really was the case, how could I ignore it? After this semester, it wasn't like she had any friends. Pariah was practically tattooed on her forehead. I might be the only one who thinks something bad is going on, I said. Maybe you should talk to her, June said. She might not think she can ask for help. Or she may not know how. Wonderful. Talking to Celia, one of my favorite things. Even if I wanted to, how could I get near her? Talking to anyone just seemed to make her angry, and we weren't exactly best friends. Keep her away from me while you're at it, Miles said. June laughed. Oh, dear, you've always had trouble talking to girls. Miles turned red. June looked at me. When we were living in Germany, there was a nice girl who would ride down to the farm and talk to him. She brought him cake for his birthday. He never spoke more than 3 syllables to her, and he never accepted the cake. She knew I didn't like chocolate, Miles mumbled, turning a deeper shade of red and sinking into his chair. That was a lie. He'd eaten the Black Forest cake I'd brought him. You lived in Germany? I said, looking between the two of them. On a farm. June's eyebrows shot up, and she looked at Miles. You haven't told her? No, he hasn't told me. June frowned at Miles, who shrugged. Well, we moved there when Miles was 7, and we came back a few months after his 13th birthday. June turned back to me. He was so upset, but after my father died, we couldn't stay anymore. The airy way she said it made me think there was more to it than that, that she was skirting something important. But she didn't continue. Miles glared at the wall with his arms crossed. You seemed to make friends okay, June said.
Right, Tucker Beaumont, the one kid in middle school who didn't make fun of my accent, Miles spat. Great friend.
I like accents, I said quietly.
So do most other people when they're coming from hot chicks and tan guys with muscles and nice smiles. Not when they're coming from a scrawny know-it-all with clothes that don't fit and no possible way to relate to other kids his age.
I couldn't think of anything to say to that. Neither could June, apparently. She put a hand up to her mouth and looked around as if she was searching for a misplaced book.
I'm going to the restroom, said Miles suddenly, pushing himself out of his chair. I'll be back in a minute.
When the double door swung closed behind him, June lowered her hand. Did he tell you why I'm here? She asked.
I nodded.
He said it was because of his father, didn't he?
Nodded again.
It was, at first. I didn't want to leave Miles with him, and I fought to get out of here. It would have been better for Miles if I had been there, but I can't deny that this has helped me. I feel more stable now. Still angry, but stable. And when I do leave, I'll be able to do what I couldn't do before. She paused and glanced at the door again. Alex,
If I ask you a few questions, will you do your best to answer them honestly?
Yeah, sure.
Does he have any friends?
I know he's not the easiest to like, and I know he thinks people are, well, cumbersome. But there's someone for everyone, and I didn't know if...
She paused and looked at me hopefully.
I think he has friends, I said. Everyone in the club is his friend, but I don't think he knows it.
June nodded.
Second question. Do people think he's unpleasant?
I would have laughed if June hadn't been so serious. Most people do, but that's only because they never get to know him and he never lets them. I think he likes it better that way.
June nodded again.
I don't know if you can answer this last one, but...
She took a deep breath, much the same way Miles had before asking me if I wanted to come here.
Is he happy?
That one caught me. Was he happy? Was I qualified to answer that? It seemed that the only person who knew if Miles was happy was Miles.
I honestly don't know, I said. But being here today, this is the happiest he's seemed in a while. But back home at school, I'd say his happiness is probably on the low side.
June's face fell.
The only reason I ask is because he tries so hard. When he's not at school, he's working, and all he ever does is save money. I don't think I've ever seen him spend a dime on anything he didn't absolutely need. Even when he was little, he wouldn't accept things that people tried to buy him.
June sighed and relaxed back into the couch.
All he ever seemed to want was knowledge, numbers to crunch, history to learn, information to file away and use later.
He always carries around a black notebook with him, and he's writing in it all the time. June smiled.
Ah, the notebooks. I got him started on those. Cleveland, his father, never liked the idea that his son was smarter than he was. He would get angry when Miles would correct him. I've always been afraid that Cleveland might have beaten that out of him, his love of teaching people.
I told him to write what he knew in the notebooks instead of saying it out loud, and if he's still doing that, then his father hasn't changed him much at all. I wanted to ask more, but I didn't want to give away the fact that I'd actually read the notebook. A different route, then.
So, what's he been saying about me?
June laughed.
All good things. He's been very worried that you don't like him.
He's been worried that I don't like him? I couldn't imagine Miles caring what anyone thought of him, least of all me. We've been breaking into arguments all year, teetering on a seesaw of perpetual imbalance, because he was always either one way or the other. Miles the jerk, or Miles the 7-year-old.
Oh, God, I thought. What if he told her about the kiss? He must have. What did she think? What did he think?
Better not tell you now.
He remembers you, said June,
and my stomach gave an odd, stunted flop. Remembers me?
The girl who wanted to set the lobsters free. That was the day we left for Germany. I was shopping for some last-minute things, and he wanted to talk to you. He liked your hair.
My throat tightened, and my heart swelled painfully in my chest.
Please don't let this be a delusion. Please let this be real.
Here it was, finally and for certain, my proof. My first completely real, not at all imaginary friend was here. I found him. Or he found me, or something.
He was real.
I could touch him. We breathed the same air. Miles chose that moment to walk back in, looking calmer than he had when he'd left. I tried not to stare as he sunk into his seat, but my brain scrambled to pull together fragments of memory, to put the boy from the lobster tank beside the boy in front of me now. June said something to him in German, and a reluctant smile took over his face. He might have been confused about what he felt for other people, but it was obvious he knew exactly what he felt for his mother. She was his reason.
It's him.
Cannot predict now. No, I'm not asking, I'm telling. It's him.
But what if...
Yes.
What if he doesn't remember?
Concentrate and ask again.
Oh, sorry. I mean, it's like if a tree falls in a forest but no one's around to hear it, does it make a sound? If he doesn't remember, did it happen?
I know June said we were there together, but she wasn't with us.
No one was.
Most likely.
So you're saying it did happen?
But if I'm the only one who remembers the details... If I'm...
Chapter 32
On the drive home, I huddled into my coat, going over everything we'd found out. It would be wrong to assume that something wasn't going on, that I was blowing all this up in my head. Something really was wrong with McCoy. And if we were the only ones who knew about it, we had to do something. But who would believe me? Who would believe Miles? I stole glances at Miles whenever I could, wondering why it still shocked me that he was the boy from the lobster tank. I simultaneously wanted to kiss him and hit him for leaving. Pressure built behind my eyes. A lump formed in my throat. I couldn't let him see me cry. He'd scoff at me or roll his eyes. He didn't seem like the kind of person that suffered tears gladly, and I didn't suffer anyone making fun of mine.
"You okay?"
he asked after a half hour of silence.
"Yeah."
My voice was definitely too high. Tucker would mock me so much.
"Hungry?"
He scanned the horizon.
"How does Wendy's sound?"
"Sure." He drove into the Wendy's parking lot to the drive-thru. I picked out the cheapest sandwich on the menu. When he pulled around to the window to pay, I fished my money from my pocket. He took one look at it and pushed it away.
"I don't want it."
"I don't care. I have money, so take it."
"No."
I flung the $10 bill at him, and he snatched it up and flung it back. This sparked a money-throwing war, which ended when Miles paid for our food. Passed the drink carrier and bags to me, and then folded up the $10 and wedged it under my thigh. I scowled at him. He backed into the parking space so we could sit in the bed of the truck and have a grand view of the highway. It wasn't much warmer in the cab, and stretching our legs seemed like a good idea.
"You're so skinny, I don't know how you're not turning blue," I said, as I settled against the cab, sandwich in hand.
Miles had already devoured half his French fries. The kid could definitely eat when he had food in front of him.
"It's this jacket," he said between fries. "So warm."
"Where'd you get it?"
"My opa, sorry again, Grandpa, had it from World War II. He was a pilot."
Miles took a bite of his sandwich.
"We lived with him in Germany. He gave me some of his things before he died. Uniforms and old newspapers, medals, all sorts of stuff."
"So after the war he stayed in Germany?"
"What do you mean?"
"He didn't come back to America. Did he like it there or something?"
Miles stared blankly at me for a second, and then he laughed.
"Oh, you thought... No, no. Opa wasn't in the United States Air Force. He was in the Luftwaffe."
All the heat drained from my body.
"Well, don't look so shocked. I told you he was German."
"But that's a U.S. bomber jacket."
"Yeah, he got it from a U.S. pilot,"
Miles replied, and at my horrified expression added,
"What? He didn't kill the guy. They were friends. Why are you freaking out? You're supposed to be the history buff. You of all people should know that not all Nazis wanted to be Nazis."
I knew. Oh, I knew. That didn't stop me from being scared of them.
"You would have liked Opa. He was very down to earth."
"So is that why everyone calls you the Nazi at school?"
"No. No one knows about Opa. They call me that because when I first started school here, I still had my accent.
I liked to speak German a lot, and when I started running jobs, they thought it'd be a funny nickname. After a while, it stuck.
Oh. I lowered my blushing face to my French fries. So, what was the real reason you guys came back to the States? Your mom was acting sort of weird about it. Miles curled his lip at his sandwich.
Cleveland. He wrote her letters for a long time, trying to persuade her to come back. I know she wanted to go, but Opa made sure she remembered why we were there. And when he died, it was the perfect excuse to leave.
He rolled his eyes.
What'd she talk to you about?
Huh?
When I was in the restroom, Miles said. What did my mom say to you?
Nothing important. Mom stuff. Miles gave me a look that said he knew that much already, and he didn't want to ask the question again.
She asked if you were doing okay in school, what people thought of you, if you had friends, if you were happy.
Miles stared down at his sandwich, waiting. And I, you know, told her.
Told her what?
The truth. Did you think I would lie to your mom?
No. But what exactly is the truth?
Well, it was pretty easy, I said, annoyed now. People think you're a jerk?
Miles snorted derisively.
Because they don't know you and you don't let them. And I said, yes, you do have friends. He scoffed.
Who, exactly? I was under the impression the entire school hated me.
The club? You know, the people you hang out with all the time? The ones you talk to?
I don't know what jungle wilderness you've joined us from, but they are not my friends. Ever notice how none of them use my name? Even Jetta says, Mein Chef. I'm just the person they're obliged to take orders from.
You've got to be kidding me. I wanted to both laugh and slap him hard. I don't even know how you can say they're not your friends. Are you trying to deny it so you don't get attached to anyone? Are you... I don't know. How can you say that? Do you not want friends or something? Even I want friends.
He crammed the rest of his chicken sandwich into his mouth and stared off at the highway as he chewed.
The rest of the meal was quiet. Me pondering why anyone, even him, wouldn't want friends. And him glaring. The lights of the highway reflecting in his glasses. We cleaned up in silence. Tossed the trash in a nearby bin in silence, and climbed back into the cab in silence. And when Miles tried to start his truck, the engine clicked.
I don't think that's supposed to happen, I said. No, really?
Miles shot me a look. He turned the key again. Click. Click, click, click. He stared at the dashboard for a few moments, tried the key once more, and then went to open the hood. This isn't happening. A cold chill settled itself along my stomach lining. I didn't want to be stuck here with Miles Richter in the middle of nowhere at night. You are dreaming an impressively lucid dream, and you will wake up soon, and it will be okay.
I have no idea what's wrong,
Miles said, his voice hollow. I got out of the cab as well and shouldered him out of the way. Let me look. I took a careful look at the engine, trying to remember what my dad had taught me about cars. I couldn't find anything either. Miles leaned against the side of the truck, scratching his head, gazing down at the ground like he'd lost something. Tucker had said Miles was awful with cars, and I thanked all that was holy that this hadn't happened while we were on the interstate. I can call, I said. Flipping open the emergency family cell phone my mom had given me. Do you know any repair places?
Do I look like I know any repair places?
You know everything else, so I figured I'd ask. I started to call home.
Car trouble?
I turned around. An older man, probably in his 60s or 70s, approached the truck with a concerned smile. For a split second, I thought I knew him. His eyes looked exactly like Miles's. Miles clenched his jaw, so I figured I should do the talking.
I looked the man over for any microphones or other strange objects. Yeah, it won't start, but it doesn't look like anything's wrong. The man nodded.
Mind if I take a look?
I shrugged, and the man shuffled over and stuck his head under the hood. Really, though? I said to Miles, who turned around looking angry and confused. If I had that many people as friends, I wouldn't be trying to act like I don't like them. And don't say you don't, because I know you do. Why do you care so much? He asked. I gazed stonily back at him. Really? You haven't figured that out yet? Deep breath, jaw clench.
They are not my friends, he said. They don't want to be, like everyone else in that school. They're there because they have to be. Will you drop it?
Fine. How about this? You know your mom's last question? Are you happy? I told her that earlier today was the happiest I'd ever seen you. That's a little pathetic, honestly. I couldn't stop the words from pouring out of my mouth. You could have friends. You could be happy. But you choose not to be.
What are you trying to tell me?
He barked so loudly I was sure the old man kept his head ducked out of courtesy.
Who are you to lecture me on being happy? You're the one taking your pills and all those stupid pictures, hoping the world doesn't go to hell when you finally slip up and someone finds out you're crazy. And you're trying to help me with my life when yours has been falling apart all year? Not to mention you've been dragging everyone else down with you. Look at Tucker, who follows you around like a dog. And I'm sure you felt so bad about that job, so bad you couldn't even tell him what you did. So you know what? If I'm an arrogant douchebag, then you're a fucking hypocrite. And we're standing in a parking lot at a Wendy's in the middle of nowhere arguing about nothing, basically, and...
His voice lost steam. He dropped his arms, defeated. His expression no longer full of rage, but guilt.
And I made you cry.
I wiped my eyes and looked at the hood of the truck, wishing very much the old man wasn't there. Yeah, well, it isn't the first time. I turned away and started walking. Crazy. Falling apart. Hypocrite. He was right. That's exactly what I was. I called him and Tucker and Celia and McCoy crazy when it was just me who was crazy. I was the crazy one. I was always the only crazy one. I followed the red taillights. I didn't know where I was going or what direction I was going in or even where exactly I was right now. I was, as he'd so rightly pointed out, in a Wendy's parking lot in the middle of nowhere, and I was going there. Nowhere. I could feel him watching me as I walked away. Maybe a few words passed between him and the old man. I plopped down in the snow at the edge of the parking lot about 50 feet away from the truck, pulled my knees up to my chest and stared out over the highway. How many times had I tried walking away from Miles? Once at the bonfire, he'd stopped me, and again when Irwin had died, and he'd stopped me again. This time he knew I had nowhere to go. Shoes crunched a path behind me, and the sleeve of Miles's jacket tapped me on the shoulder. Here, he said. I pushed the jacket away. Don't want it. I wiped my eyes again, tried to stop my shivers. All those layers of sheepskin, it was probably like a toaster oven inside. I'm sorry I called you crazy. Why? It's true. I pulled my knees tighter. I'm probably going to end up inside the hospital with your mom. No, you're not. He sounded exasperated. Your parents have already considered it. That stopped him. So you can take your stupid jacket, because you'll probably freeze without it. What's your body fat percentage? -0.00 oomph. He knelt down and flung the coat over my shoulders. Not looking at me, he pulled the coat tighter and said, "You're so damn stubborn." Though he tried to hide it, he shivered. "Come on. Let's go." He offered a hand, and I took it, using the other to keep the jacket on.
Strangely, he didn't let go of my hand when we got back to the truck. As an experiment, I squeezed a little. He squeezed back. The old man peeked around the hood and smiled when he saw me wearing Miles's jacket.
"Well, it looks like your battery might need a little juice," said the man. "I've got jumper cables. Should only take a second."
He popped the hood of his car and pulled a pair of jumper cables out of his trunk, and after a bit of instruction on his part, he and Miles set to work. I almost fell asleep standing up, and Miles had to prod me out of my stupor when it was time to go.
"Thanks again," he said to the old man.
Miles's voice was weak, brittle.
"Really, it was no trouble."
The man smiled and waved, stowing his jumper cables again.
"You kids enjoy the rest of your night."
He got into his car and drove away. Miles stared after him, a small crease between his eyebrows. "What's wrong?" I asked, one hand on the passenger side door handle. Miles shook his head.
"It's nothing, I just..."
He made an exasperated noise, his shoulders drooping a little.
"You made me think of Opa."
He walked around to the driver's side and got in.
"Oh, wait!"
I shrugged the jacket off, climbed into the truck, and handed it across the seat to him. "Seriously, your lips are turning blue." "I'll be fine, really," I added when he started to protest. He feigned reluctance well as he slipped the jacket back on.
"He told me to give it to you,"
Miles said, after a solid minute of staring out the windshield. I was about to make a joke about how good that was, because someone needed to teach him some manners. But then I saw the look on his face.
"Let's go,"
I said softly. "We shouldn't be too far from home, right?" Miles nodded and threw the truck in drive. Chapter 33. 20 minutes later, I had to start talking to keep Miles awake. My lengthy lecture on the Napoleonic Wars, one of Charlie's favorite subjects, was cut short by the familiar streets of town and what I could only describe as a message from God. The Meyer sign. "Stop for a minute," I said, turning around to look at the store.
"What?"
"We need to go to Meyer."
"Why?"
"Trust me, we need to go to Meyer. Pull in and park." He swung into the parking lot and drove as close as he could to get to the doors. I almost had to drag him out of the cab and into the store.
"I work here all the time," he whined, yawning. "Why do we have to stop?"
"You're a baby when you're tired, you know that?" I pulled him toward the deli counter. His co-workers gave us odd looks as we passed by. Miles waved them off. The main aisle was empty. Miles nearly crashed into the lobster tank when I stopped in front of it. He blinked once, stared down at it, then looked at me.
"It's a lobster tank," he said.
I took a deep breath. "Now or never." "It's the lobster tank," I said. "Your mom told me you remembered." Miles looked back at the tank, the water reflected in his glasses. At first I thought I'd been wrong, that the odds had been too high, that maybe my mother had been right this whole time and I had made the whole thing up. But then he said,
"Do you do this all the time?"
"No," I replied. "Just today." The corner of his mouth twitched.
"You smell like lemons."
I rose up on my toes. He turned, his hands finding my waist, his lips finding mine like he'd been preparing himself for this moment. Saying I wasn't ready for it was an understatement. I wasn't ready for the emotion, and I wasn't ready for the way his long, chilly fingers worked their way under my jacket and sweatshirt and shirt and pressed into my hips, raising goosebumps on my skin. Everything around us drifted away. Miles groaned. The vibration rippled through my lips. The heat. How did I not notice the heat? There was a furnace between the layers of clothing that separated us. I pushed away. He breathed heavily, watching me with alert, hungry eyes. "Miles."
"Sorry,"
His huskier-than-usual voice didn't sound sorry.
No, I... Do you want to come back to my house?
He hesitated for a moment. In his eyes, I saw him working out the meaning of my words. It took him so much longer to figure it out than a math problem or a word puzzle. Those he got immediately. This took all his brain power. I had to believe he'd been born with this confusion.